All right. Good afternoon. This is Julie Fedorchak with the North Dakota Public Service Commission. We're gathered for a work session titled Requirements for Completeness. We don't have any cases identified for this specifically, but because we're looking at this for future cases, as it applies particularly to wind generation facilities. So we have Commissioner Brian Kalk on the line. Hello, Brian.
Hello, how are you doing, Madam Chair?
Excellent. How are you?
I'm doing well. I actually even have notes and comments for today all prepared, so I'm ready to go.
Excellent. And we have better take 1 minute to recognize the Division I championship acquired by the University of North Dakota over the weekend.
Whoop, whoop.
Whoop, whoop. Randy's still carrying his NDSU cup around, but we'll get him converted. We should add a bet on this deal so you guys could be wearing Sioux jerseys today.
Oh, I would never bet against you, Indian hockey. I was there in 2000 when they won.
Oh, anyway. All right. And Commissioner Chrisman is here as well. Do you have any opening comments, Brian? I mean, Randy?
Just to let Brian know that, Brian, this morning, Julie is forcing me to refer to her as champ now. So
that's right. It's a good thing you're absent, Brian. It would have been painful. Just kidding. Do you have any opening comments?
Well, actually, Madam Chair, it's always a little bit more challenging when on the phone, but I do have a couple thoughts. I was thinking about this work session as we prepared for it a little bit, and I think that, let me just throw these comments out just before the discussion starts ensuing, but one of the things I want staff to really understand is that I think from my viewpoint, this has been an evolving process where we've had this discussion over the years about what it takes to make an application complete. I think that staff has done a great job with different commissioners wanting different things at certain times, and different times certain things have caused us to, I won't say fast track, but maybe fast track a little bit, where we've had a big push to, get gas flaring under control, so maybe we move some applications through quicker than other applications just by the priority that was being set in different areas. So I want staff to get the sense that I think they've done a great job responding to three different commissioners over the years, and I think that's one of the challenges as we get into this that I thought of. I think this is a great idea. We talked about this last motion we had recently about 30 days, have locations for the turbines. I think those are things that three of us will probably mostly agree on. But I think one of the challenges in the past, we tried to develop like a checklist for what makes an application complete. It's not as easy as that because you may have one commissioner that wants things the other two don't require, and it can get controversial over certain things. I mean, just recently I wanted more information than the two of you did about Eagles, where you two might not have needed that to make a decision, but I wanted it. So I don't want us to go too far down the road where if one commissioner really thinks one, we should have to have something for an application to complete, and the other two don't, that's what there's three of us. So I think this is a great discussion, but I wanted to cue that up because I think that there'll be broad agreement on most things, but there might be to where it might get cumbersome. That's what there's three of us. So I look forward to the discussion. I think it's a great idea, but I wanted to cue it up with those comments.
Thank you, Brian. I'll follow that up a little bit with some thoughts, too. So I've looked both at our rules and the Century Code for what's included in there in terms of requirements for applications, and there's a pretty comprehensive list of items. I think the gray area, as Brian points out, becomes that, some of the items are vague and listed, and some companies provide a lot of information for some of these and others not much at all. So I think that this is a good opportunity to revisit what is required by law for these applications and how do we then best account for that in our process in terms of deeming things complete and then moving towards the hearing and making sure we have the information that's required and, more importantly, anybody who's interested in these projects from the public also has time to look at that information in advance of a public hearing. So I think this is a good chance today to go through, remind ourselves what's required, what's spelled out in the law and the rules, what and how various staff see that and are using those guidelines to determine the completeness, first of all, and then what kind of parameters we want to put on in terms of days for receiving any items that maybe aren't provided in the application, but we might be able to have a little bit of an extension for the company, deem it complete, but require them within a certain number of days. So Jerry has provided some information, and I'm going to turn it over to him to kind of go through what that is. Does Brian have this?
No.
Okay.
Sorry, Brian.
Brian, are you at a computer?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm sitting at a computer. That's no problem at all.
All right. Is this something you could email to him or not really?
Not really. I'll tell you what it is, Brian. It's just a copy of the regulations, the rule as to what needs to be in an application to call it complete.
And yeah, that's okay. I can pull that up myself, so I'm good to go.
Okay. The other thing I gave was just a copy of the certification checklist that the companies file with their applications for wind farms. And it's the first few pages in an application, really. I've asked them to repeat that information from the administrative code and everything else with a page number section or something labeled as to where in the application it's found so that I can just check things off.
And is this checklist something that you give them to begin with, Jerry, or do they generate this?
It has evolved over the years. And now it's turned into pretty much the list from the administrative code. But in addition to that, they usually add the Century Code 492208 says what needs to be in an application.
Mm-hmm.
And then 2209 says factors to be considered. And so they want to show where all of those are at in the application, too.
But in terms of my question,
did I get
they generate this.
Yeah.
We don't give them this to fill out every time.
Well, no,
so
we
don't.
So
sometimes they don't include all of this, or it's up to the company whether they want to include the Century Code references, the factors, and all that.
Kind of. But, you know, what I tell them is to go look at an old application online, and it's spelled out in there. And so they get this from what's been done in the past.
So when you say kind of, are all of them doing this?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
So if we're ready to start going through this.
Yep, go ahead, Jerry.
Okay, great. This one that I have passed out was for the Brady Wind 2. I'm sorry, Brady Wind 1 application.
And now I'm wondering, why are we using this one since it's one of those that's pending? I'd almost rather not talk about this one because it just drives us straight into that details of
okay,
that case.
Okay, good point. We don't need to.
So I like the idea of going through one of these, but not on the case that we're currently contemplating.
Yeah, I only did it because it's the most recent thing I've done.
Right.
So let's not talk about this and instead go to the rule itself.
Okay.
And so this is 6906-0401. And subsection 2, starting with contents, application must contain. And so it starts out with a description of. And now these things were for any energy conversion facility and not just wind. And mm-hmm. So in some situations, you have to use some discretion applying them. But the type of energy conversion facility proposed, so wind, gross design capacity and net design capacity are next. If you had a regular plant, a thermal plant, you would use a certain amount of the power output to produce the electricity from it. And sure. So there'd be a net design capacity and then a gross design capacity. In the case of wind, that's the same thing. And so we just go with nameplate capacity there. Next one, estimated thermal efficiencies. That would be not applicable for wind. Number of acres per facility will occupy. For a wind facility, generally there's the project area, the whole inside amount of the line that goes around for the area that you're designating. And then within that area, there's a number of acres that will be permanently impacted. And that would include the actual foundations and the access roads, and generally the collector mm-hmm. line runs with the access roads. But
okay.
Hey, just a question on that. When you talk about the size of the project area, Jerry, I wonder if this is one of those areas that, you know, we always get wrapped up, and it's for good reason, about, you know, participating landowners and non-participating landowners. And so you've got a project area that's, let's just say, 30 square miles. And if you've got 100% of the project area that's participating or some other percentage, it seems like right away the project area in relationship to what percentage of or what type of participating landowners are in that area. You know, if it's a coal plant, they're going to have 100% because they're probably going to buy it. But I don't know if I mean, Joe, if that's something you guys want to segue off on, but to me, that's kind of going to become a big deal for us going forward, is the project area, to what they put in there, to what they studied, to what we finally carve out. So I don't know. I guess I'll just listen to see what your thoughts are there.
You're saying that we should be perhaps looking at an additional requirement being identifying clearly the participating and non-participating landowners within the project area?
Well, I think somewhere that's going to become a big point to deal with.
Yeah.
I think it's a very important part of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll add that to my list of potential additions. Participating and non-participating landowners. Okay.
Location. Well, I guess I was just thinking, like, let's, you know, the application says that the project area is 30 square miles. You know, there should be a caveat there to perhaps it says it's 30 square miles, of which X percentage participating. Just so right up front, we know what we're dealing with, and they know that becomes a factor. That may become a factor.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm not sure if it's later in one of these criteria or not, but we might as well just throw it out there since we're talking about this. So percent of total project area with participating landowners. Then also, because I don't think it's spelled out on any later criteria, but it affects the non-participating and participating, is location of turbines, distance from the nearest participating landowner, nearest distance from occupied residences. That's our current criteria. And I don't know, do we require that any place specifically, Jerry, currently?
It's not in here.
Okay. Let's see. Distance.
When you say residence, I presume you mean occupied structure.
Yeah, occupied structure, yeah. Sorry. From was there anything else in that kind of vein of things that?
Well, one of the things that has bothered me on some, we need maps, and if we're talking 20,000 acres, they need to be multiple page maps. Of course, if it's a 2-mile pipeline, maybe one map is fine, but large enough and clear enough that we can really look at how this thing lays out. And so I think it's important not only to show the turbine location, but not just that it's 2,100 feet from a residence, but where we can see where the residence is.
We used to...
There was, in fact, a couple of times in various cases, I don't know, I know I've done this more than once, where I've looked at some of them that whatever their setback was, whether it was a county where it's 2,000 feet or a different amount, whatever they said, where I looked at some of them and I thought, man, that looks awful close. And I just asked that question about that specific occupied structure, whether that is in fact that distance or more, and made them confirm it on the record. So I think it is important that we have that map with the occupied structures.
So we used to specify minimum map scales.
I think it can be handled in a table, personally. I mean, you could specify minimum map scales if you want, but I like to see it on a map so it's visual, but then I like it when they say, here's all the distances from the turbines to the, you know, and then it's in a table because you get the exact distance then. And I think that's just as helpful as a map where I might be able to eyeball that distance with a key.
That's a good point. Tables are good.
They are. I really like maps, though.
The maps, when we used to specify minimum scale, that was before we really had computers to where you could blow a thing up on this computer screen and see it in whatever scale you wanted. And we ended up with fold-up maps in these applications that were kind of a hassle in the files.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's how it ended up being like it gotten to now. But I think it was like 1/2 inch to a mile or something like that was our minimum acceptable scales.
Well, these maps where the sheet folds over and are in our binders. I mean, I don't want something that, you know, you take out like a big paper map and unfold it and lay out on the table, but when you can page through and find the one you're looking for, I find that a great convenience.
Is it possible to determine what that scale would be to keep the maps a reasonable size?
Well, it's tough to nail it down depending on the project, but
right.
We could use a word like reasonable. A minimum reasonable scale or something to give some discretion to us as to whether or not we can read it. That's just
a map that clearly identifies the maps, that clearly identifies occupied structures, distance from turbine locations, supplemented with a table that spells out the specific distances.
I get the word clearly in there. That helps.
Let me just throw a thought out here, too. I remember having this discussion a couple of years ago, and I remember saying that, you know, we're trying to get to all electronic applications, and why are we having companies print off, you know, reams and reams and reams of paper? And I remember myself thinking, as long as I've got a good map that's electronic, I can have John print it off, or I can blow it up myself. I wanted to get rid of the having all these reams of paper that companies had to print off. So that's one of these areas that I think it gets challenging, because just that, one person may want a hard copy of the map, the other ones are completely fine if they get the electrons of it. So, I mean,
well, and as we move to the electronic filing, which we are, we will be able to get maps printed to the scales that we want,
because yeah, we'll be running them ourselves. There.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. So, next on our list here is anticipated time schedules. And it goes through a list of the things: obtaining the certificate, completing their land acquisition, starting construction, completing construction, testing, commencing commercial operation, and then any expansion or additions beginning. And there's generally not any controversy there, except that their dates are what they hope for.
Right.
Then we're up to where it gets a little more iffy. B here, copies of any evaluated studies or assessments of the environmental impact of the proposed facility submitted to any federal, regional, state, or local agency. So any studies that they had to do for anybody else, they should provide us a copy. And so we don't specify what's any studies that they need to do.
They'll get
those from other agencies. We'll say we want a bird and bat study or something like that. And so those they'll submit to us, but they're never ready at the time when the application is filed and deemed complete. So
now, if you were to compare that one to what the law says, a summary of any studies which have been made of the environmental impact of the facility. And, you know, the law gets into some more...
Of what?
And then it also requires an evaluation of the site with regard to the rules. Considerations of the avoidance areas and... avoidance areas and exclusion areas.
So if you were to take that literally, what you just read, Julie,
mm-hmm.
a copy of any studies that have been done. Let's read that again.
Summary of any studies which have been made of the environmental impact of the facility.
Yeah, which have been made.
Right.
So at this time when this is filed, those are in progress.
Okay.
So they haven't been made yet, and they'll file them when they're made. That's where the way this has been kind of done, but, you know, before the hearing. But, you know, that's not always totally right either, because sometimes, not for a wind facility, but for a transmission line or something where there's eminent domain involved, a lot of times they can't get on the property to do the studies until after they get their permit.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it says at least two or three times in the whole general citing law and criteria that we are to do this in an orderly manner compatible with environmental preservation, efficient use of resources, minimizing human environmental impact. So the companies have to do the studies, whether it's for us or for these federal agencies. So they're doing the studies. It's just a matter of whether we require them to have them here.
Yeah, and I guess what I'm saying is our rules don't specify any studies. They don't deliberately require a wetland delineation study.
Mm-hmm.
Or any, that's done for the Corps. Our rules only refer to studies they're doing for somebody else so we get a copy of them. And so, like, you know, if you go through there and look at those, what studies are being done? Well, of course, the cultural study is the main one for SHPO. And a wetland study, which is generally first done from a desktop type thing, looking at maps. And then there's a delineation study that's required to go out in the field and actually draw boundaries around wetlands to where, if it's a core jurisdictional wetland, they actually need to have it delineated so they don't go in it.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the wetlands that they delineate, I don't know if there's a requirement that we actually have them delineated. They're an avoidance area. I think that's more for their own benefit to stay out of the wetlands if they can with facilities.
So I guess what would be the question here today is, are we going to specify some of these studies that we have been receiving? Do we want to now specify that those are required and needed to deem the application complete? Are there, or more generally, are there specific studies that we want to do that with, say, the bird and bat, the eagles, the raptors, the, you know, do we want to be more prescriptive, I guess, is the question, and would that be helpful to staff, or does that get to what Brian's saying, where we're, you know, we want to be careful about being too specific?
And, you know, I think that in those cases, what we really are deferring to the experts, SHPO may not need a Class 3 survey. And so if they don't ask for one, then I don't think we should require it. If it were me and I was SHPO and they were going through a plowed field, I wouldn't think it was necessary to send the cultural resource team out there in that field of plow that the farmer just got done plowing. But, you know, but then again, maybe they're the experts. Maybe they think so, because maybe it's deeper than he plows. But, so I'd like to defer to them on, same with the birds and bat stuff and everything, going to Fish and Wildlife's. They're doing this stuff because Fish and Wildlife wants to see it, and so if they do it, they file it with us. But however, there are noise and shadow flicker studies that we don't have a requirement in the rules anywhere that they be done. Those are ours. And I would think that if we get these rules rewritten, that there should be something in there about that.
So, Jerry, you just described, I'm going to play devil's advocate to what we've been doing a little bit. You described that the sound and the flicker, those are ours. But we're deferring to these other agencies to basically use their expert judgment, which I agree with and support. But I don't see that in the citing law it says that we should be turning to SHPO and we should be turning to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and we should be looking to all of those agencies to tell us whether this is, you know, minimal environmental impact. It doesn't do that.
I think that it kind of does. And that,
where does it do that?
I can't quote you right now, but I'm thinking that the way this thing works somewhere in there, it says that the other agencies shall come to us if they got problems.
Yeah.
And if they don't, then they got then they don't have problems.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of think that's the concept.
That's in our rules too.
You know, Jerry, that's one of the areas I think that I would disagree with. That we have to figure out individually what information we need to make a decision. And so I'm not going to wait for Game and Fish to study this forever. I may not wait for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The SHPO, in my mind, I like the fact that they can do the cultural stuff that they offer up some of those things, but we've given them over time a special status almost that they didn't necessarily want or even had to have. So I tend to agree that yes, it's good to consult with these agencies, but at the end of the day, when I have a decision to make, I will look at information that I deem appropriate and I'll vote yes or no and I'll put findings in there accordingly. And, you know, to me, when I look at a wind farm, you know, the shadow flickers, you know, the noise studies, I don't ever have a benchmark. I know there's other people out there that may have numbers, but I had data that I base a decision on. So I don't like turning all that over to these people. And that's where I go back to my opening comments about basic requirements for an application complete, I think should be as minimal as we have need for a basis of making a decision, understanding three people may go different ways and what additional information they require. I don't think it should be a checklist as easy as A, B, C, D, E. So it's tough. I get that.
So where do you go for environment? If we're getting to the point where we need to, you know, evaluate something is complete or not, that's what we're trying to provide guidance for staff on so that we're consistent. Is environmental and the cultural stuff, is that required Do we need that to have the application complete? Or if not, at what point do we have to have it to have a full record? And at what point, how far in advance of the hearing should the public be able to see that?
Well, I think, Julie, the point that you bring out is the public part of it. That I think, for me personally, okay, if it's a bugs and butt bunny study I don't think they have to have that complete until a decision is made. But I get the question about how soon should the public be able to see that. I think that part of the standing thing of where if someone who wants to, you know, appeal the hearing, they've got X amount of days to do that after our decision is made. But somebody who has the status of, you know, what they might want to look at, once again, agrarian, but I think that as long as they know where the turbine locations are at, as long as they know the noise, as long as they know the shadow flicker, I think that's the kind of stuff public has a right to understand and have a look at ahead of time, whether there's a tidewater goby nest somewhere or not that is or isn't on their property. I think that's where it becomes a little easier for me to say that's something I don't need right away. I just need the basics of what the potential impact to their person is.
And I mean, that's common sense factors. I agree with you on those. I think where we get into a challenge moving forward is that we're going to be in an environment where folks are going to be looking for reasons to oppose these deals, and they're going to be looking to some of these other broader factors, like the environmental impact and cultural impact and that sort of stuff. So, I mean, if we want to do it on a case by case, I think we can make a case for that. Go ahead.
You nope. Paused, and then I looked over. It looked like you were not done.
No, go ahead. That's fine.
Part of me wants to agree exactly with what Brian is saying, that you can't get an orderly checklist on this. But then the other part of me is thinking to the hearings that we have and the information that they ultimately get, whether they have it 2 weeks before the hearing or at the hearing or a few hours before we vote on it in a commission meeting, sometimes some of these things are a little vague. And if you don't have it before the hearing, then you can't ask questions about it. And I don't want this to get to be our citing process is to get to be a situation where they withhold the information so we don't ask a lot of tough questions about, I'll use shadow flicker or the noise as an example because there are numbers associated with it. And like Brian said, I don't have a specific number in mind that it just can't exceed that, and as long as it doesn't, it's okay. But, you know, if there's a whole bunch of them affecting dozens of homeowners at 49, that's different than if there's one at even 48 and it's a participating landowner and things such as that. So it's nice to have that and be able to ask questions about the things that are a little fuzzy in it. And if we don't have that yet at the hearing, there we sit. We're holding a hearing so we can ask questions, and we don't know any of the information about which to ask.
We don't have any standards on flicker that I've seen, but we do have a rule on noise, and it's 50 decibels to the within 100 feet of inhabited residence or community buildings. So that one, actually, we have an established criteria.
I'd forgotten that was in there. I was thinking that was kind of a rule of thumb thing, but
yeah,
I'd forgotten.
Not on, for wind. It's specific for wind. It's not for other energy conversion facilities. But we don't have one for flicker. That one's more of the rule of thumb.
But so the bottom line then to my statement is I don't know where to draw these lines or exactly which things. I don't have specific recommendations, but I don't want to just shift it all off to, whenever they get it done, it's fine. Because much of this information, I think we need to conduct a good hearing and ask good questions.
Well, if I could just sort of cut to the chase on a few of these things, Randy, Brian, you've listed turbine locations, noise, and shadow flicker studies as being sort of the bare minimum that you think the public needs to be able to effectively evaluate that. So I think I agree with you, and I think we should add that to our list, that we have to have those within, we just established 30 days. That seems reasonable to me of the hearing. So I'm comfortable with using that as a guideline moving forward. I don't know how you feel about that, Randy.
Well, to me, those are kind of the key things, if we can also add the occupied structures.
Right, which we talked about that.
You know, some people might not be able to quite associate on a map
distance
exactly how their home lies in that or something like that.
Yep. Then the other question becomes a little bit more fuzzy, but that is, are there other studies that we know we aren't going to be satisfied without? Eagle studies, the bats, the raptors, bats, and those types of things, and should we be including those as well?
There would be one other one that we never pay any attention to, but as far as it never makes it into the record for discussion, and that's the microwave beam path studies.
Oh.
And so we should add that to our list of, if we were redoing these rules, of things.
Microwave, is this for the transmission lines?
It's generally for wind turbines. They can interfere with a microwave beam path, and so they need to do a study of the paths that are in the area and so that they're not expecting to get in any of those paths and disrupt them.
And is that one that you think we have to have before the hearing?
It's one that they would have to have done well before the hearings. It's okay. Not one that we're ever having to wait on.
Okay.
And we might be paying very close attention to that. We just haven't had a lot of questions.
Yeah. And generally it is something that they take care of right away. If they had
top priority.
These things are small little beams that come through, and if they move a turbine just a little bit, and they'll be fine.
Mm. So what about, how do my colleagues feel about the bird, bat, the raptors, the participation, what do they call those conservation plans? Or
If I could, Julie, I think I'll maybe answer your questions, both of them, but what I'm basing this on is back to my experience back when I was an environmental compliance guy in the Marine Corps. You know, we'd always go out, let's say we build a new rifle range or a new airfield somewhere, and you'd always have people around there that some liked it and some didn't like it. So the human factors, the ones I talked about, you know, the noise and the shadow flicker and all that, those are definite things we had to work with. But when you get into the bugs and bunnies stuff, you've got all these resident agencies that are quote-unquote experts, and a lot of times they'll never give a final answer. They'll say, as long as you agree to consult, the services might give biological opinions. I mean, so these are like ongoing discussions where even if they'll never give a letter that says it's okay, because at the end of the day, they maybe have to do some enforcement on it, or they may have to change something down the road to species. And the SHPO kind of does their letter and walks away, where I think that's the oddity. So I think I'm okay with all the bugs and bunnies stuff, as long as that's put together before a decision is made. I think they'll never have all this stuff before the hearing. They'll just say they can show what they've reached out and talked to these agencies, where their current state of consultation's at. But I don't think that's a factor that will be easy as a button up on as a noise study.
So tell me if I'm misunderstanding something here. These not really be in my portfolios. It's hard to get a clear statement from those agencies that this is going to be just fine and there's nothing to worry about. But they do give responses when they have a major concern, correct?
Not always, Randy. They sometimes, in my experience with the different agencies, they may overlook it. They may choose to not look at wind towers, where they might look at coal plants more because of direction they may have from a current administration. So just by their silence doesn't mean that they don't have concerns.
Well, it seems my kind of theory on this, however good it is, has been that since we can't seem to rely on them to give us a clear answer that, that something will be just fine, my whole thought has been that at least they need to have been notified of the project and the details of the project somewhat in advance. I don't have a certain time schedule, but not the day before. And that they have had some time to respond. If in the case of eagles and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, if they're aware of it being a huge issue for some eagles or for some whooping cranes or whatever the case may be, if they chose not to respond, I guess I don't feel like we can do anything about that, but they should have been notified. And so that's what I look for, is were those agencies that have expertise in those areas notified of the details of this project some reasonable time in advance?
Yeah, and so if I could speak to that, there is a list in the administrative code of agencies that are to receive notice when an application is filed, and they're on our list, and so they get that notice from us. But in addition to that, I've told the companies all along here, and we've done this the whole time, that they need to contact all of those agencies in advance and explain their project to them and make sure that those agencies don't have any problems with it. Get a written response from them if you can, and submit that with your application in an appendix, all of the responses that you got. And the companies have been pretty good at getting that done and submitting those responses with their application and submitting copies of the letter they sent and so forth. And it's really in their best interest to get that done, because they don't want these agencies showing up at the last minute with concerns when they're trying to get their permit in place and something unexpected comes up. So
would you be suggesting that we have a checklist when the application comes in, and we can check the agencies that have been notified?
You got to turn your mic on, Pat.
Are you suggesting that we have a checklist then when an application comes in, that we can identify the agencies that have been notified in advance of the project and given a chance to respond? And if that's the case, then should we ensure that all the agencies, the same agencies that we have on our list, have been notified?
What do you mean?
We have a list of agencies that we have to notify when we get a project that we've deemed complete and that we're going to have a hearing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a list of agencies in our rules.
And then also with the checklist in the front of these applications, the factors to be considered under 492209, there's a list of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so in their table that they prepare with their application, saying where this stuff is at, the last one of those is problems raised by federal agencies, other state agencies, and local entities. And so that's generally where those letters come in.
I didn't quite follow Pat's question. I think what I heard you say is, do we have to get a checklist of all the, we have a list of all the agencies that they contacted and follow up with them, or what were you asking, Pat?
Would the commissioners like to know before an application is deemed complete that the applicant has contacted each of the entities that should be contacted? And I'm thinking at least the list that we have that we contact when we do the notices.
Um, I don't necessarily think that I would need that. But I think it's incumbent on them to contact them and get the information back, because it's going to be required long-term. But to deem it complete, I don't know that I would have to have that list.
I don't have real strong feelings on it, but I kind of think that they should have. Because otherwise, where else do you draw the line but the point at which we deem it complete? So we get out there, and yeah, they haven't notified these agencies, and here we're having the hearing, and so no one knows whether there's going to be a strong response from one of them, or they notified them yesterday, and you couldn't expect to have had a response yet. And so I don't know, would that, any of those agencies, should there be a hardship? And that they're sending us an application with enough information, they're expecting us to call it a complete application. Should there have been a hardship in the app for the applicant to have sent that to those agencies at the same time?
It has not been an issue.
We do the same thing. We send them an app, so they do get notice. At least because we send them notice.
Yeah,
so
they get the notice from us.
No matter what, at some point, whether the company does it or we do it, they get at least 20 days or 20 before the hearing.
20 days. Sometimes the company. I've seen situations where the company has just notified the agencies, and so they've had maybe a week longer than the 20 days to respond to the project. So, I mean, it wouldn't be that hard for us to check and see if they've contacted each of the companies, because in their application they file a correspondence.
Right.
It's just, do you want to use that as a determination of whether the application is complete?
I don't care whether we use that part of the completeness determination, or just make clear to them that it had better be out within, 20 days before or what. But you know what? If they don't get it done then and it gets to be 19, then I think we should cancel the hearing and start all over again. And then they're going to be screaming because, you know, they've got deadlines to meet and everything else. But if it's too much to expect them to have notified those at the same same time frame as they're expecting us to deem it complete, then just some clarity to them that it had better be done by that 20 days, or I'm kind of indifferent which way we go on that.
Right now there's no requirement that they legally in the rules or law or anywhere that they send notification to these people. That's on us, for us to send it.
And we have our list.
Okay. I didn't realize that. So how do we send it if they don't send it to us?
What? How?
How do we notify an agency of what's going on if we don't have the information yet?
We send them a notice, a copy of the notice that we issue for the hearing. And then...
After we deem it complete and set a hearing, we send that out to this big, long list of agencies.
Yeah. And so they get notification.
Here's the project. Here's where it is.
They get notification of the hearing. And so this puts it back into the applicant's best practices, or, you know, if they want to navigate their way through this process successfully, it's in their best interest to have contacted all of those agencies and make sure that the roads are paved for their application. Otherwise, something could come up that they're not expecting. And so that's why there's not been any issue with this, because it's in their interest to make sure that those agencies are on board.
I misunderstood that. I thought that they contact these.
They do contact those agencies, but it's only because we've told them it's in their best interest to do it.
Required.
Yeah.
It's so that they don't come up at the last minute after we've sent them the notice saying, this project is occurring. Do you have anything to say about it?
Yeah.
And then so the companies have just realized it's better to get their input ahead of time versus having them come in at the end. And that's what you're saying, right, Jerry?
Yeah, and you know, most of these developers have been doing this for a while. And so they already know who these people are in these agencies and so forth, and they're probably contacting them before they even
If you're a person that is very concerned about cultural resources in an area and you're following this through the public record and the company chooses not to go through that trouble since we're not requiring it, when we deem something complete and tell the SHPO that it's complete, but no one has sent them a copy of anything because just no one has ever done that yet, wouldn't it be fair for the public to assume that those things that, that they're worried about, that that person is worried about regarding cultural resources, has actually been in check, has actually been checked out to make sure that nothing is damaged, when in fact we've deemed it complete, even though nothing has been done on it, and no one has ever sent the SHPO really any information about it, other than the fact that we deemed it complete.
So, well, that gets to the whole crux of this matter.
Yeah.
Is, I mean, the burden is on us. We're the ones required to determine whether this meets the standards of law or not. And so there's been all this material and these different consultations developed over time that companies have done to help make that case to us. And so none of that is spelled out really, prescribed specifically in what they are required to. It's sort of just developed over time. So the question is, do we need to now spell that out to say this is what we've learned over time we need to determine whether something has this minimal impact, and this, and we have to have this in order to make it complete, or do we just need it by the time that we make a decision?
Hey, Julie, can I chime in here for a little bit?
Mm-hmm.
I think we're going down a road here that we got to step back a little bit. I'm going to try to walk through these with my notes here. That the first one is to have a list of things that people have to notify before we can deem it complete. I don't think that's appropriate because we have a notification process, and we deem it complete. We notify all these agencies. They have 45 days. There would never be a full list of people that we would fully have for deeming something complete because who would you get? You get different counties every time, so I definitely don't agree with that. Now, the road we're going down now, if an individual that is concerned about an animal that's not on his or her property, giving them special status when they're not the agency that has jurisdiction on approval of it, I think that's the road going down that we don't belong going down. That the legal process is we get an application, we deem it complete, and I understand we're having this discussion, but we have it deemed complete with enough information that we reasonably think we can make a determination on it. If we want to add more, we can. But then we go through, we notice it out there. If someone has a vested interest in it that they want to, they can request to intervene in it just like anybody else can, and we will move the hearing back until they have all the information that they have. What we're trying to do here is have it both ways. We give everybody all their information they have and then give it to them ahead of time and then try to do all these things that we may or may not need for us to make a decision, not someone else. And so I think that there's a process in place that it's good to get it out there, but if someone has an interest, they have X amount of days to intervene after we notice it. If they come to the hearing and have concerns that aren't answered, we can continue the hearing. We can do whatever we want. We hold the cards. We can keep wrapping ourselves around the axle here when I don't think we're going down the road here that we should be going down on some of this.
Yeah, and I keep reminding that myself anyway that the application's never fully complete. I mean, if you deem it complete, it doesn't mean you'll stop learning about it.
Mm-hmm. Alana's coming up to the mic, and I'm glad because she's been kind of listening here. And I'm curious what your take is, Alana, having done this for a lot of years, just from a legal standpoint.
Sorry. Well, as far as that discussion about notifying the other agencies, I mean, basically that was described to you accurately. But there are plenty of rules that to me, and I'm quickly going over them, and Pat and Jerry have them memorized, but the application must contain, and there's a list of things, and there are provisions in there that talk about all of the stuff that they need to be getting from these other entities ahead of time. They have to have their studies done sufficient to cover all the criteria that you're going to go use eventually to decide exclusion and avoidance areas. They have to, and it has to be sufficient to enable the commission to evaluate the factors, and then there's a whole chapter on what those factors are. Mm-hmm. So I think if you, you know, take a little while to go through it line by line, but I don't think you can follow those rules unless you do what Jerry said we have always said to them was best practice. Okay? The rules that say what the application has to include.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you've gone to all or most of those entities and garnered all of their input,
right,
you're not going to be able to get your studies done correctly or your maps or your mitigated measures or all the other things that are in our rules that have to be in your application. And well, Pat and Jerry can speak to this more thoroughly.
Well, do you have thoughts on the deeming complete then? Because we've gone to, you know, should we just have a case-by-case basis on what is complete? Or is that something that we should be more consistent on and have a checklist of?
Go ahead.
I think we had already gone there and said turbine locations, noise and shadow flickers.
Yeah, I got all that. I don't want to go through that again. I'm talking about the environmental stuff.
And so the rest of it, I'm in favor of it being like a case by case and get them in so many days before the hearing. And, you know, even then, like I said, with the problem with not being able to get on land and stuff like that, sometimes that's not even possible, which even speaks to more to the case-to-case kind of like thing, because for the Cultural Resource Survey, in the end, what we want is a sign-off from SHPO, and we may not get that until after the permit's been issued, and we've done that several times. The other practical aspect, like I mentioned before on these studies, is that the snow gets off the ground here and sometimes in like April, May, and they're trying to get out and get these studies going, and they need to start construction in the summer before the end of the construction season. And if you withhold the application being complete, waiting for them to finish all of their field studies, which they weren't able to start yet. It's just from a practical matter, it works better to allow them some time to finish their field studies and file the results after the hearing's been noticed.
Then, Alana, this is more of a legal question. Is there any sort of a weakness to that process if, say, the public comes back and says, well, we didn't get to see these studies. They came in after the hearing.
Yes. And that is what happened in the Brady Wynn case. They came in late, and the stuff hadn't been studied yet. And there was a request to delay the hearing, to start the hearing, and we granted it. And I don't.
Well, but let me just chime in here, though. There's back to the environmental stuff. These environmental issues are not as easy as 1 + 1 = 2. I think the initial studies have got to be presented at some time before the hearing or in the hearing, whatever. I don't care. But the initial studies, these studies could go on. They will go on forever. And so there will. Initial studies, yes. Final studies, no, because there will not be final studies in these things, because they will continue to evaluate.
Is that clear enough to staff?
I think so. If we get in a bind with an intervener claiming that they didn't have time to look at the study, and it ain't been filed yet, well, then they're right.
Well, and I think the thing here that we need to be conscious of is when you guys are bringing motions to us deeming something complete, that there's an understanding that we're all on the same page of what that means. If I see it's complete and there isn't a 30 days time period, you know, 30 days ahead filing of the environmental studies and the and all these other things, then I assume all that stuff is in.
And I should even apologize for quitting writing memos to you guys, saying that, you know, I'm recommending that you deem the thing complete, even though these studies are still underway. And if you look back, I used to do that on the cases, and I guess I thought that you were used to seeing them or something. And so, yeah.
I was going to say an internal checklist, a checklist in the division and the commission and how things work, that this is in and this isn't, and the staff's reasoning why this time it's okay to take it without that, and next time it might not be.
Yeah.
You know, that would be a simple, it could be a memo, it could be a checklist. You know, a simple way to do it.
That sounds very reasonable to me, and kind of rephrasing what Brian said, except for I'm on a little more specific point because Jerry had talked about it. On some studies where, and I think it had more to do with power lines and things like that where eminent domain could be used, but where they don't have the authorization to get on the land yet. Now what we're talking about here I think plays into that well, because if they have 3/4 of the land acquired, there's no reason why those studies can't be done on most or all of that. And in many cases that tells us a lot about what they're going to find on the other percentage that they don't have permission yet. So I think, you know, we're kind of moving in a good direction here of not everything has to be 100%, but the alternative to 100% doesn't have to be nothing either.
Right. And it still gives a flexibility on the case by case. The companies have enough clarity in law on what the factors are and what they have to get us to have a complete application. But then staff will provide more summary to us about what the application does or doesn't have before we say, yes, it's complete and set the hearing dates. I think that feels good to me. Plus some of these other things that we cited earlier in the meeting.
The one thing I just throw out there that we're talking just wind farms now. There should never be eminent domain on a wind farm. Now, the associated power line with the wind farm, okay, but I thought we were just talking wind farm discussion because we move over to power lines, it's a broader discussion, but wind farms, there should never be eminent domain.
Yeah, I kind of strayed, but I just wanted to make that point because it's important to me and I thought it would be fun.
Yep.
I strayed bringing it up in the first
place. Yeah, but in my understanding today, we're talking about wind generation projects. Okay, so do we have enough to go on? You're going to restart the process of sending us memos, kind of outlining your assessment of the completeness of the application.
When we give you a recommendation that it's complete, we'll give you whatever studies are left that we're aware of to finish.
And then we're going to add, and I guess this might need to go to rulemaking, or I'm not sure how we do this, Alana, Jerry, but the...
I'm thinking eventually we'll go to some rulemaking somewhere, but we have another work session on the 20th or 21st of April, something like that, to talk about the wind turbine rules.
Okay.
And so maybe we would end up with a rulemaking here out of all of this.
Sure. We can add this. Is there any way, meanwhile, to communicate this to the companies that we really want these? Maybe you can spell it out, Jerry, write it out, and then give us a copy of it so we can say, yeah, that's what we meant. And then when you get a wind application, you can look for this stuff, and if they don't have it, maybe you can send it back and say, please provide this prior to, you know,
okay,
30 days or whatever, because they're going to need it for deeming it complete.
So what if I said, the turbine locations, which are preliminary at the point where they file it, but finalized, are we up to 30 days
before? 30 days.
Now? Okay. And then shadow and noise flicker, and distances to residences.
Mm-hmm. Occupied structures.
And then...
And a delineation of the non-participating, participating land segments.
And then they should give us dates when they expect that any pending studies are
sure.
are going to be completed.
Good.
So I think we're up to, in our list here, 2C, an analysis of the need of the proposed facility.
Yeah, that was the one other thing. I think the rest of these, I'm just going to buzz through because we're running out of time.
Okay, I'd like to scratch that one.
The need?
Yep.
Yeah, I think it's in the law someplace, Jerry, too.
Is it the... Where are you at in the law? 49-22-09?
Let's see here.
Factors.
08-1.
Certificate of summary of any studies, a statement explaining the need. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Never mind. I guess we can't take it out. yeah. But, you know.
You just don't have to emphasize it.
Yeah. And I have not been on the applications that I do. Paying any attention to the need part of it, just thinking that it's not a factor that we consider. But it's tough when you end up sitting through all this testimony from interveners or somebody trying to explain that the thing's not needed. It'd be better off if they just knew up front that that was not a factor.
Well,
I don't think that's going to dissuade them.
I think what would be really helpful is if the companies provided better information on that addresses that.
On the need?
Mm-hmm.
So you'd rather see more information on it or better?
Well, like, for example, well, we don't want to talk about that case, but there, when we have a power line case, for example, yeah. you always have the local co-op showing up saying, we need this.
Well,
or the basins. So, and that's an important factor for the public in the whole. Well, geez, you know.
And I guess I'm
someone's gonna have
not
to have
thinking
it.
Power lines, but yeah, for power line, you got a not necessarily a PC&N case. For a public utility, they need a PC&N. For a transmission provider, they need a PC&N. So there's a separate certificate of need process. I have to think that through a little bit. The thing with it is that a co-op, I don't think, has to show the need at all.
Well, I think it's nice having it in there, and I think we can all give it whatever amount of weight or consideration we want. I've never heard from them that it's been a problem providing that information.
No. yeah. Well, I don't think we can because it's included as one of the factors in law. So.
So D is the same thing. Feasible alternatives to serving the need.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get on to E as a study area that includes their proposed site of sufficient size to enable the commission to evaluate the factors in 49-22-09. And so in their application, there will be a map showing the area, and then there will be their proposed project area outlined within that area.
Mm-hmm.
So what basically you just want to see a bigger area in case you want to shift the project area a little bit.
Right. I don't have a problem with E.
F. Discussion of the utility's policies and commitments to limit the environmental impact. And so that's not hurting anything.
No.
Is that one, though, the study area, though? I couldn't catch all you're saying, Jerry, though. Back to the participating, non-participating, where that's got to relate to what you just said somehow.
Not really, because it's showing an area bigger than your proposed project area.
Okay.
So everybody outside the project area would be non-participants.
Okay. I got it. I'm tracking that.
So then we were just talking about then they'll give you a map that's bigger than the project area, showing avoidance and exclusion areas and other such things in the general vicinity. So G is that map. And on the map, you should identify the criteria that led you to pick out your proposed project area. And I wouldn't think there was any need to change that either. It's not always clear criteria that, you know, they got their easements here as a reason, but H, a discussion of the criteria evaluated within the study area. And so there's where we talk about selection criteria and policy criteria and exclusion avoidance areas, things like that. A discussion.
Did you read all these, or are there some of these that are?
No, I think I looked at the rest of these. I think they're good.
Okay, I'm kind of glancing over the rest of this, too, here right now.
Yeah.
I mean, if you don't have a suggestion on them, I don't think.
No, I think the rest of these are fine and don't really have I don't think we need to make any tweaks on the rest.
I didn't have any tweaks in mind, but Jerry, if you do have things that are causing concern, I don't want to hurry along.
No, I'm good with the rest of it, I think.
Okay.
Just if I could, Julie, I'm good with the rest of it too, but I do have a bit of a Pandora's box to open up with you guys, and maybe we need to reschedule or think about it, but there was one thing that we hadn't hit on that was on my notes that I've, you know, been the guy that's always said, you know, X amount of feet from, you know, occupied residents and all that, and that's kind of been the criteria that I've used in my mind for the last several years. But I have thought more about maybe we should be looking at the setback from non-participating property lines. So it's a change. But, you know, let's say we use 1,400 feet from a occupied residence. Well, what if that person doesn't want to be participating? So why should we encumber their land all the way up to their property line, even if they don't want to participate? Why shouldn't we use 1,400 feet from their property line? And that's probably back to the discussion that we have coming up here, but I'm toying that back and forth in my mind. I don't know what the right answer there is, but it is something I've never thought of until recently.
I did note in our administrative rules that we have a setback from non-participating landowner property lines.
Okay.
It's 1 1/10 the times the height of the turbine. So that's what our current setback is from a property line of a non-participating landowner unless a variance is granted. So actually, we've got some precedents already in our rules for using that marker, you know, non-participating landowner's property line. It's just that it's a pretty short setback.
And that's not such a short setback. I mean, that's 500 feet, roughly.
Now,
Brian, you're on your property. You can't put it any closer than 500 feet away from your neighbor's property.
Right.
So that's like a zoning thing. How close can your garage go to your neighbor's property line? I don't know. 500 feet is.
Yeah, it's just it doesn't get into. It's fall down distance, right? So you can fall. It can fall down onto the neighbors, but it doesn't perhaps get into any sort of the sound from the property line or
no,
flicker from the property line or, you know, so some of those things to the point of future development on that property, you know.
Yep. And
that's what I think that's what Brian's getting at, isn't it, Brian?
No, that's exactly right, because I do remember the 1.5 turbine length, but that's not even close to the distances we're talking here. So, no, Jill, you queued it up. That's exactly what I'm thinking.
You know, it gets pretty, you're into the property rights discussions and stuff pretty heavily on that. If somebody wants a turbine, wants to put it up on their property, how close can they be to their neighbor's property? It almost seems like a local issue more than ours. But while we're on discussion.
Not all those kinds of things are local either. Think I'm wrong, try damming up a creek.
While we're on that discussion, though, I was going to save this for our next work session, but we have avoided establishing a minimum setback from residences. And maybe we should discuss whether to do that.
Well, I don't like putting all these rules into place that may or encumber future commissions, so I don't like any more rules. But I think the three of us having discussion is very appropriate. And Alana, I don't know if you're still there, but you know, back in the days when we used to build coal plants and those things, I mean, what kind of setbacks did we have from residents in those things? What kind of guidelines were those days? Because there's some parallels that we could draw to other types of generation.
I don't recall there was ever a distance setback from a residence for a coal plant.
There would be in local zoning, and I don't know what it is, but I don't think it'd ever be an issue to us because it would be taken care of locally.
Okay.
I hear from different people that they wish the state would have a minimum setback, and that way they could either use that or adopt something bigger than that, and then they could point to the state's numbers and say theirs were better.
Well, I have seen the PSC's 1,400 feet referenced in tables in previous applications, but I don't see it in our rules.
We never adopted that.
It's not in our rules. I hope we didn't want to put it in the rules because there's different times where it might not be appropriate, and I didn't. I mean, it just kind of evolved, Julie, that people thought that was the rule because that's what we settled in. But if there was terrain and hillsides and trees and all that stuff, it could be less or it could be more. And but we did develop a rule of thumb. But I don't like putting hard numbers like that in code of any kind.
Yep, and that number was also for a small turbine, which was at that time 1.5 megawatt turbines.
Right.
So the turbines have gotten bigger too.
And the okay.
You know, I'm only just casually familiar with this, but where do the health departments? And I don't know if it's a rule or a law or what on like feedlots or things like that would cause smell. You can't put one near your neighbor's house, but I don't know what distance it is or any idea what they have going there.
I don't.
I'm guessing that's a rule, but I don't know.
Yeah, I always thought about like a pig farm in Iowa.
Is it hard to find? Is there any other?
Every other farm.
Is there any guidance from other states in terms of the property line, distance from property line? I'm guessing this, you know, 1/10 times the height of the turbine is probably an industry standard. From the property line of a non-participating landowner, but
you know,
would we be able to find out if there's some sort of if other states have looked at this property line issue more?
I can ask around and see what I could come up with a little bit. You know, off the top of my head, Minnesota has had different requirements for how close turbines can be to each other and stuff like that. Maybe there's something going on there.
Julie, one thing that I put together with just my work with the other commissioners inside the MARC is that the states that are actually truly wind developers, like, you know, North Dakota, Kansas, Iowa, Texas, we're the only state that does this to ourselves of trying to put all these numbers together. The other states, they basically just turn it loose to property rights and say, if it's yours, you can do what you want with it, and some are even not even cited. So I think what we're doing is the right thing, but the states that actually have wind development don't have hardly much there. In the states like Minnesota that claim they're wind developing, they put all these rules in place that have driven out wind development, plus their wind capacity is low.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that you've brought up a good question for the next work session. We can all think about it if Jerry or staff can drum up any guidance from what other states might be doing or looking at. That would be helpful. And otherwise, we've gone through all of this for the completeness. I think we've provided some new, slightly different direction to staff and clarified some things, so that's great. And we'll have another discussion on any additional changes for wind sighting in a couple weeks at our next hearing. Any other thoughts, Randy or Brian?
Just one thought, Julie, that I thought Jerry made a good recommendation of sending the memo out before we'd have the motions to deem something complete. But I would just throw out there, when the memo comes out there, you know, if these are very controversial wind farms, maybe we should have just a quick work session almost before. You know, if there's any questions, we should, the three of us, sit down and talk about it before we deem it complete than anything else, because we want to make sure we're doing this stuff the right way, obviously.
I think that's great, and maybe the portfolio holder can make the call on whether we need a work session. Are you comfortable with that?
Absolutely.
And if I need one or feel like I get a memo that alarms me, I'll certainly speak up. Okay. Thank you, Jerry, Alana, Sarah, Pat, for sitting in here. Julie's here, too. And that concludes today's work session.